Good afternoon, Your Honors. Christopher McHenney, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Branch Banking and Trust Company, or BB&T, I may refer to them as that. First, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may, and I'll try to keep track.
Yeah, it's up to you.
Okay. Briefly, BB&T is the lender by assignment of the note and deed of trust that's an issue in this case, which is brought under the Spurious Lien Act. There are a number of issues in our trial brief, or in our appeal brief. Time won't permit us to go through all of them, so I'm going to try to touch on the high points here and submit the remainder on the briefs. We brought this appeal because if the trial court ruling is allowed to stand, the appellee, Mr. Piskus, will walk away with a $220,000 windfall by obtaining the refinance of a mortgage on his home and extinguishment of the trust deed that was held by Branch Banking and Trust Company, BB&T. We start from the position that BB&T, as an assignee in the chain of commerce that did not originate this loan, is free of any misconduct in the underlying transactions that might have occurred. The record here is replete with evidence to establish that BB&T did not come to the court then and now with clean hands, did not participate in any misconduct in the way the loan was originated or in its subsequent assignment or transfer. The trial court made a number of errors in the way this case was handled. First and foremost, it erred when it struck the counterclaims that we brought within the rubric of the Spurious Lien Act claim. One of those claims was a claim for an equitable lien. In essence, that if there's an error, a defect in the underlying deed of trust, that the lender is entitled, as a matter of equity, to an equitable lien to prevent unjust enrichment. The court dismissed that on a motion to dismiss, saying that that was at odds with the Spurious Lien Act. We submit that was error in that it occurred, essentially prevented this litigant from having its day in court on a very important
issue. Why is that, Mr. McIntyre? You said that throughout your brief, and I may be missing it. I don't understand why you can't bring the claim. The court said you can't bring an equitable lien counterclaim in this context because it's an expedited proceeding, it's a limited proceeding and the like. You said repeatedly in your brief that you're out of luck, you can't bring the claim. And I guess my question is, why not? You can bring a separate action now, with all due respect to Mr. Piskus or his wife. You have claims against them you can bring. You're not barred because you didn't get a chance to litigate them. You may have a time issue now and statute of limitations, but that's a different question.
Your Honor, it's something that we have actually thought about and are prepared to proceed with if we had to. The problem, of course, is that the stripping away of the equitable lien claim in the Spurious Lien proceeding denied us a defense that would allow us to validate the instrument that was an issue in that case and exposed us to liability in that action. But if the goal is a multiplicity of lawsuits with potential for conflicting verdicts and different decisions in different courts, then the trial court in this case did a good job with that.
Counsel, if we do it the way you're proposing, then they have 21 days to come in and file. You have 21 days to file your counterclaim. Then there's any third party claims. Then the third party has 21 days to assert any claims it may have against you or against the petitioner. And the petitioner has 21 days to assert a claim. You end up going out 63 days. Assuming nobody files a motion to dismiss, there's a motion to dismiss. All that's put on hold, and so you end up with not an expedited proceeding. You're going on for quite a period of time. So isn't that inconsistent with the whole concept of rule of whichever rule it is?
Well, we talked about Rule 105.1
and the statute specifically.
Yes, Your Honor, I would posit to the court that Rule 105.1 and the Spurious Lien Act was not intended to abrogate a statutory or other contractual or common law claims. It was designed to deal, it's a kind of a punitive statute, to deal with those documents which on their face are so lacking in validity that they can be disposed of summarily. Rule 105.1.
Why does it say that in the statute?
Well, there's language in the legislative history which we've cited in our brief that says that it was intended to deal with those kinds of instances where neighbor disputes, someone records outrageous documents, to provide a speedy way to obtain relief from those types of instruments.
Is it your position the statute's ambiguous?
Yes, I would say it's ambiguous, Your Honor. But moreover, I would say that the rule implementing the statute as promulgated by the Supreme Court says that the trial court has discretion to continue proceedings for purposes of trial so that all issues can be adjudicated. And in fact, there was a continuance in this case for some time just due to the schedule of the trial court. But fundamentally, the error here is that the court misconstrued the statute to say that it excludes all other potential legal claims that might bear on the validity of the underlying trustee.
It excludes it from that proceeding, but it doesn't prevent you from filing other claims.
If we want to litigate in a multitude of jurisdictions, yes, Your Honor. And moreover,
why would you be in different jurisdictions?
Well, in other words, we'd have to file a different lawsuit in a different venue or in a different court, potentially. It might be in front of a different judge in the same court, for that mm-hmm. matter. The second error that we pointed to in our briefs is that the court compounded this problem by stripping away our defenses, but secondly, by putting the burden of proof on the lender here.
Before you move to the second point, your briefs raise a constitutional due process spin on the counterclaim issue. Did you raise a constitutional issue before the trial court?
I absolutely did, Your Honor. In the first hearing, I said the risk of to the trial court, I said summary adjudication risks error and implicates due process concerns. Okay. I made that crystal clear. Okay. And I fell on deaf ears, but ultimately we did preserve that issue. And I don't think there's any dispute as I read the briefs of Appellee in this case, that we preserved any issue. I think we preserved every issue that we brought forth here today. The court erred in addition by putting the burden of proof on the lender here, who is a stranger to the underlying transaction. The court was very clear in saying, as I read the statute, you have the burden of establishing why your lien is not a spurious document.
Isn't that what an order to show cause is? I mean, the statute says the order to show cause gets issued to you.
Yeah.
So you get to go first.
Yeah, and our interpretation of the statute, Your Honor, is that that the statute imposes upon the lender the burden to come forward with a pleading showing their position, a responsive pleading saying this is our position as to why this instrument is valid, and it's reserved for an evidentiary hearing to decide whether or not a claim has been made under the Act.
But doesn't the statute use the term hearing to show cause, not an evidentiary hearing? It consistently uses the term hearing to show cause.
It does use the term show cause.
And the show cause is on the lien holder, right?
But we've cited the cases to the court. The burden of proof in a civil case always rests on the party who's the plaintiff, the party who's intending to upset the status quo.
Tell us, what's the prejudice based on this area?
Well, the prejudice is that there are compounding types of prejudice. Mm-hmm. The first is that this case largely rests on the testimony of a husband and wife. My clients were not parties to the transaction. They don't know all the details. And we're put in the position of having to anticipate the testimony of the plaintiff and put on our defense to what we think they're going to say in court.
Now, Did you depose?
We had three depositions in this case, the notary, the plaintiff, and the wife.
Okay.
And that's another issue. We got very, very limited discovery here.
I think,
and that implicates due process
issues. And what is the specific surprise? What is the testimony that came in that specifically surprised you and that you were prevented from defending yourself?
Well, for one, there was an expert, Mr. Vitalik, who was a computer technician expert. Because this was an expedited proceeding, we didn't have an expert report from this gentleman, and we essentially had to kind of do some informal discovery in the courtroom while this gentleman was testifying. He offered testimony on about the content of the computer that had allegedly been seized from the wife's residence and information that was thought to be important as to what her motivations were in undertaking these various mortgage loans. That's one example. I mean, there are a number of situations where just being put in the position of having to counteract testimony before you've heard it fundamentally changes the fairness of a civil trial.
And you called the owner as your first witness, right?
Yes, we did. We called, and because I had to. You know, that was a strategy there because the court had put that burden upon us. Another point, I want to talk about ratification. I think there's pretty clear evidence in the record that the plaintiff, Mr. Fiskus, did ratify the underlying trust deed. Standard of review, we've got tax returns that were offered into evidence that were produced by the plaintiff. The court can draw its own conclusions about those, but from the import of those documents, it's crystal clear that this gentleman claimed tax benefits in the form of mortgage interest tax deductions that were attributable to the loan that's at issue in the spurious lien proceeding to the tune of in excess of $20,000.
And is it, there's testimony that he didn't sign that?
Yeah, he claims that he didn't know that his wife had signed his name, but...
And the court found it, right?
Yes. What I would say, in addition, though, Your Honor, is that despite the fact that these returns were filed in 2009 and 2010, when this case rolled around in August of 2012, Mr. Fiskus had not renounced or amended his returns or in any way attempted to avoid the tax benefit that he had previously claimed. In other words, there was an unauthorized act, he claims, by the wife. He accepted the benefits of that transaction by claiming these tax deductions that are attributable to this very mortgage loan.
Well, hadn't he paid the interest?
But, well, yeah, he had paid the interest.
Okay, well, unless and until he gets the interest back, which apparently hasn't been requested, why isn't he entitled to the deduction?
Well, if you're paying the interest on a mortgage loan that you now say you don't owe, you essentially ratified that transaction.
But is there any evidence that he had actual knowledge, which I think is what's required for ratification, he had actual knowledge of all the material circumstances? You're drawing the inference that he must have known because his wife signed it, filed them for him. Well, is there any evidence of his actual knowledge of those material facts?
The tax returns were one of the few documents that were actually produced to us in discovery by Mr. Fiskus. That was one of the few things that we were able to obtain. They were in his possession. He testified that he found those documents in his home. These documents were in his possession. He discovered, he says, the existence of the problem in late 2011. And when the trial concluded as of 2012, he had not renounced or failed to claim, or in other words, repudiated these deductions on a loan that he says he never undertook.
So the ratification, you're saying, is based not on the filing of the return, but on his failure to renounce at some later date.
That's correct, Your Honor. One of the other issues I wanted to address, and it's a weighty one, is the holder in due course issue. The holder in due course doctrine under the Uniform Commercial Code recognizes that even a forged instrument, as has been alleged here, can be enforced when the holder takes it in good faith for value and with no knowledge of default or any defect. The court found, and it's one finding that we do agree with, that BB&T took the Fiskus loans for value and in good faith. I seem about out of time here. And it's our contention here that the statutory provision, the holder in due course doctrine, renders that instrument valid and enforceable as against Mr. Fiskus.
How's the deed of trust a negotiable instrument? You're trying to tie them together,
yeah.
The note and the deed of trust. I looked at the cases you cited. I don't see that.
Well, we've cited a couple cases, and I think probably closest is the Harwell v. Bigelow case, which is a Colorado Supreme Court opinion that we've cited to that says a promissory note and a trust deed are part and parcel of the same transaction, and that they together constitute a negotiable instrument. The deed and trust and the loan, promissory note, are two documents that interrelate with one another, and a default on one triggers a default on the other. Both are construed together. And in fact, the Uniform Commercial Code says if there is a collateral pledge as part of a negotiable instrument, that doesn't render the instrument non-negotiable. So from our perspective, they are a negotiable instrument. We've cited binding authority on that point. I think that's beyond dispute at this point. The trial court erred, I think, in concluding by excluding the deed or the promissory note by saying we're going to segment this transaction to ignore what it really is, which is a mortgage loan. I think that's where it made its mistake. Again, if the instrument is valid under statutory law, then it's valid and not a spurious document under the Spurious Lien Act, because it's a document that's created by judicial action. And I see that I've run out of time, but if there are any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Judge Gabriel, Judge Webb, Judge Miller. As we all know, this case...
Counsel, would you just introduce yourself for the record? Which one of the two you are?
My apologies, Your Honor. David Dodaro on behalf of Ray Fiscus, the petitioner in the underlying case and the appellee in this case. This is a spurious lien case brought under 38352.04. It arises out of a theft committed by forgery by his wife of 30 years, Vicki Casper Fiscus. In June 2008, Ms. Fiscus signed Mr. Fiscus's name on three powers of attorney without his consent, instruction, direction, or authorization. Her daughter notarized that signature. Her daughter, Teresa Brazulis, who is not the biological daughter of Mr. Fiscus. The power of attorneys appointed her as his attorney in fact, and she used those power of attorneys to obtain a promissory note in the amount of $120,000 in Mr. Fiscus's name, which was secured by a deed of trust on Mr. Fiscus's property that he owned solely.
Mr. Darrell, let me interrupt you and cut to the chase here,
because yes,
I do think we know the facts pretty well.
Of course.
Tell me, to me, the biggest question on your side, what I have for your side, this feels inequitable. It feels like it should be a holder in due course case. So there's two issues there. First of all, assuming that we can get past the negotiable instrument issue, are your opponents there holders in due course, assuming we have a negotiable instrument? Question number two is, do we have a negotiable instrument based on the argument Mr. McEnany made?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to answer the first question first, because I think it is fundamental. The trial court in this case found that the deed of trust was not a negotiable instrument because it was a security agreement as opposed to a promise. I think that result is correct, but there's a more fundamental reason why the deed of trust is not a negotiable instrument. And that fact, or this determination, is defined by the factual findings of the court. Document is a negotiable instrument only if it is a promise or order, right? I apologize. We did not address this in our brief. We rested on the trial court's conclusion of it being a security instrument as opposed to a promise. But this, I think, is definitive on the issue. An order is a written instruction to pay signed by the maker. It's analogous to a check. I'm sure all you gentlemen are familiar with that. A promise, on the other hand, is a written undertaking to pay money signed by the person undertaking to pay. That's 43103 subsection 9. Here, the deed of trust is not signed by Mr. Fiscus.
Well, let me interrupt you. I don't think Mr. McEnany disagrees with you. I don't think any of us disagrees with you. The question is, do you read the note and the deed of trust together, as I understood Mr. McEnany's argument?
I don't, but I don't think that's necessarily relevant, Your Honor,
okay.
Because if this document, if the deed of trust, and the note for that matter, is not a negotiable instrument because it's not a promise, well, then this holder in due course issue is not even applicable.
And you're saying it's not a promise because the signature is forged?
Correct, Your Honor.
But isn't forgery one of the defenses that cannot be asserted against an HIDC?
Correct, but not correct, Your Honor. Let me explain. The forgery concept set forth in 43406, all right, is narrower than an unauthorized signature, all right, under the UCC. An unauthorized signature includes a forgery of signature like we have in this context. A forgery under 43406 speaks instead to a situation, for example, and it's illustrated in the example or the official comment to that section, where you have a signature stamp and a person is negligent in leaving the signature stamp available to somebody, and that signature stamp is used, so it is the signature of the maker. It's their stamp. but that's nevertheless is a forgery. And that's what 43406 speaks to. And I think that there's even more support for this kind of analysis, because the analysis that this is not a promise and therefore cannot be a negotiable instrument is consistent with 43401, which specifically states that a person who does not sign an instrument cannot be liable under it, period. 43403 says a person cannot be liable when a document is signed by an unauthorized person or there's an unauthorized signature in it. And then furthermore, 43308 speaks to the evidentiary and procedural aspects of these types of cases where if there's an issue as to signature or whether a signature was done by the maker has to assert that as an affirmative defense in a lawsuit under a note. And that kind of triggers a responsibility or requirement or burden on the holder to demonstrate the signature is authentic or authorized. So in no cases under the UCC will an individual be liable for something he didn't sign. It's almost as if I signed a promissory note, Bill Gates. Bill Gates is not going to be responsible under it.
This argument is not raised in your brief, right?
It was not raised, Your Honor. Judge Miller, I apologize for that.
It's a little bit difficult. You're making the argument after he's completed his chance to argue. We normally don't consider arguments for the first time raised in all argument. Thank you.
I apologize. I think that the reason why I'm raising this, Your Honor, I think it is definitive on the issue, and it is more of a fundamental rationale. I believe that the court has authority to affirm the trial court's ruling on grounds other than employed by the trial court, and I think in this context, it is definitely appropriate to do so.
Well, I think you also kind of went down that road and are trying to answer Judge Webb's question, and I want to come back to that because I'm not sure I understand the answer. Judge Webb asked you to confirm that a forgery is not a defense against a holder in due course, and you said maybe and maybe not.
Well, I mean,
I'm afraid I didn't understand the answer. Which one is it?
I'm sorry, Judge Gabriel.
Yeah, it may be my fault.
No, I probably was not clear. I apologize. A forgery is not a defense to a holder in due course, but a forgery as used in the context of the UCC is limited to that situation, for example, where a signature stamp is used.
So you're saying
forgery, the concept, excuse me.
So you're saying that the UCC forgery provision for purposes of HIDC is exclusively limited to an unauthorized signature?
I wouldn't necessarily, I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that is correct. And I think if you look at the commentary to Section 43308, it makes it very clear that a holder must establish an authentic signature before the holder in due course defense or aspect is even implicated.
Well, let me ask you that, and forgive me if I'm just, maybe it's just been a little bit of a long day.
Of course.
When we look at this issue and the holder in due course, are we looking at the deed or which? Because we have a forgery, clear forgery, on the power of attorney. The deed was actually signed by the wife, you know, falsely without authority. Which document are we looking at?
Well, I think they're both a forgery, Your Honor, because
You said if your forgery is defined as an unauthorized instrument, that's what I'm asking.
An unauthorized signature.
Unauthorized signature, right. Okay. So, well, the first one, the power of attorney, it's not even it. She signed his name. The second one, she's signing under the false pretense of the power of attorney.
Right. She is signing on behalf of Mr. Fiskus, so that is an unauthorized signature.
Right.
In that context, the holder has a remedy against the unauthorized signor, and that's set forth in Section 43403. So they have a remedy against the forger, as I'm using that term loosely, Your Honor, to mean an unauthorized signature. And in our position, from Mr. Fiskus' standpoint, the UCC or the factual findings of the court define the fact that this is not a promise and therefore not a negotiable instrument. And that's really consistent with Colorado law, which also holds that a forged deed conveys nothing. We cite those cases in our brief, Your Honors. So I think this is a consistent kind of thing. Mr. McNamee has indicated, well, this there's an inconsistency in the law. There really is not an inconsistency in the law.
Do you have any dispute, and please don't assume anything from my question, I'm just trying to play it out. Do you have any dispute as to the bank's good faith or any issues like that? Would they be a holder in due course if we had a negotiable instrument?
It's unclear, Your Honor. There may be an issue as to the close connectedness doctrine in this context. That issue was not raised or addressed or evaluated in the context of this case.
Let me ask it a different way then. Does the record show that there, based on what we have in the record, if there was a negotiable instrument, would we have to find that the banks were holding in due course?
I believe so, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Very quickly, the factual findings by the trial court, which are, as we all know, essentially unassailable because they are supported by substantial evidence, essentially definitively address the ratification issue, the UCC issue, and the statute of limitations issue. I will not bore the court with those detailed factual findings, but they are set forth in the order, and it's clear that the factual findings of the court demonstrate there cannot be any ratification under the standard for ratification. This is not a promise under the UCC, and the deed of trust is not a promise, excuse me, and that Mr. Fiscus brought this matter timely. The appellant raises some legal issues, and there was some discussion earlier about the dismissal of his counterclaims and third-party complaint, and we think that was completely inappropriate given the special statutory procedure which we have here.
Well, are you taking the position that the spurious lien determination would be res judicata as to any claim such as one for an equitable lien, or do you recognize that those would be completely separate actions subject to considerations such as statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I would agree they are completely separate. Actually, I guess my take on the equitable lien is that it's actually a remedy as opposed to a claim. I think it's probably a remedy for an unjust enrichment type of claim.
I agree with you. Do you agree that that is not barred by res judicata because you won the spurious lien case?
Yes, Your Honor, because I just think the standards are completely different.
Okay.
I will not speak to that any further. I think it was appropriate, given the expedited nature of this proceeding, as indicated in the case of Spencer, that we cite that I'm sure Judge Webb is very familiar with. But even if this wasn't an expedited, a special statutory procedure, these claims would still be inappropriate. Third-party complaint under Rule 14 is to recover against a third-party plaintiff or a claim against a third-party plaintiff who may be liable for all or part of the plaintiff's claims against it. Well, here we didn't have any claims against the bank. We're seeking to release a spurious claim. So that claim or counterclaim is clearly improper. Likewise, the counterclaims are improper even if this is not a special statutory procedure because it was not asserted in a pleading as defined by Rule 7. Rather, it was asserted in a verified response contemplated by 38-35-204. With respect to the burden issue, shifting the burden of proof, the trial court actually ruled, I do find respondents have the burden in this case to show cause why the lien is not spurious. That was the August 14, 2012 trial transcript at page 25. So rather than shifting the burden here, the court simply required the respondent, or the appellant in this case, to fulfill the procedural requirements of Section 38-35-205 and Rule 105.1 both of which require the respondent to show cause. So I think that was definitely applicable. But even if a burden was shifted inappropriately, which I don't think occurred in this case, essentially no harm, no foul. They had a full and fair opportunity to present evidence, and they did so, and they had a full opportunity to rebut our evidence, and they, I don't think, did that. I'm sorry I'm up. Thank you so much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Your times are exhausted. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.